Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Do not, as we once did, define our interests only regionally. We are a nation with global interests, and the fact that we have committed both a significant quantity of lethal and non-lethal aid, I think $90 billion, to Ukraine, I think demonstrates Australia's identification as a responsible global actor, which will always stand up for the international rules-based order, sovereignty, and liberal democratic values.
Welcome to the National Security Podcast, brought to you by the ANU National Security College with support from policyforum.net. In this episode, His Excellency the Honourable George Brandis QC, Australia's High Commissioner to the United Kingdom, joins Will Stultz to discuss the UK-Australia relationship, AUKUS, and Russia's war on Ukraine. Before we get into it, we'd like to acknowledge the Ngunnawal people, traditional owners of the land from which we broadcast. We pay our respects to the elders past, present, and emerging.
High Commissioner, thank you for making time for a conversation.
Pleasure, Will.
So there's a lot of topics concerning your career and the state of the world today that I want to get to. But obviously, it would be kind of remiss of us not to start with the crisis in Europe and the invasion of Ukraine. So I suppose, firstly, there's been talk over the past few weeks or so of a negotiated diplomatic resolution to the invasion. I mean, as a diplomat sitting here in the UK with a lot of insight into what's happening in Europe, I mean, how do you personally regard the chances of a diplomatic resolution as situation stands at the moment?
Well, obviously, it's what everybody wishes for. But it's such a highly mobile situation that it's very difficult to be predictive. The expectations of Putin obviously have not been met in terms of his military operation. The Ukrainians obviously have shown tremendous courage and tenacity, and there is no sign of that abating. So we seem to be, as we speak, at a point at which it's almost reached a stalemate. Now, that is the condition in which one would expect the prospects of a diplomatic solution to be optimal. I mean, when one military force seems to be succeeding, its incentive to resolve a dispute diplomatically are fewer. If the two forces, the armies and the irregulars, particularly in the Ukrainian side, the irregular combatants have fought one another almost to a standstill, then that is more likely to produce the rational conclusion that the only way out of this is a settlement. But of course, and I use the word rational deliberately, there seems to be a high degree of irrationality and a high degree of misappraisal by Putin of the true situation, which makes judgments about the likelihood of rational actors acting in a particular way very difficult.
So one of the things as well that's struck me about the Western response to the crisis, and I suppose the initial response to the invasion specifically, was that nations acted, I guess, simultaneously, but not necessarily in a kind of centrally coordinated way, you know, in the sense that we weren't waiting for President Biden to give us a big barnstorming speech before we all acted. So I suppose from your observations close up and thinking particularly about Australia's response to the invasion, you know, is there anything, I suppose, how would you characterize Australia's response? And was there anything that kind of surprised you about the way Australia responded?
Well, I'm very pleased with Australia's response. And the answer is no, I'm not surprised at all that the Australian government was very, very strong made those strong statements and adopted those strong measures very early in the piece. And Australia has won over recent years, I think, a very admirable reputation on the international stage as a nation that can be relied upon to be tenacious and committed in its defence of liberal democratic values. We do not, as we once did, define our interests only regionally. We are a global, a nation with global interests, as the Foreign Policy White Paper of some years ago now made clear. And the fact that we have committed both a significant quantity of lethal and non-lethal aid, I think $90 billion, to Ukraine, which is not of regional importance to us, I think demonstrates Australia's identification as a responsible global actor which will always stand up for the international rules-based order, sovereignty, and liberal democratic values.
And on the long-term implications of this invasion, you know, it's obviously going to consume a great deal of attention for the UK here and for European countries as they seek to resolve the conflict, but then also to kind of reconstruct and rehabilitate Ukraine itself. Mm. You know, in this context, I suppose, how confident can countries like Australia and Japan and others in the Indo-Pacific be that there is going to be a steady British and European commitment to the Indo-Pacific, given their attention will be drawn to Europe as well?
Well, this is being much spoken of in London at the moment. I was addressing a breakfast of the Council on Geostrategy about this very topic on Tuesday. And on the one hand, there is the obvious observation that the attention of the United Kingdom and of Europe is now focused largely on Eastern Europe and on Ukraine. But I don't think it's a zero-sum game. That doesn't mean that interests in the Indo-Pacific abate. Now, because as I pointed out to somebody the other day, I mean, whatever at the Foreign Office the other day, whatever may be happening in the Ukraine doesn't change what is happening in the Indo-Pacific. It doesn't change Chinese policy. It doesn't change the regional tensions. It doesn't change the vectors of population growth. It doesn't change the creation of a large Asian middle class, an ever-growing Asian middle class. It doesn't change the internal politics of ASEAN. It doesn't change tensions between India and China. So allowing for the fact that Ukraine, for obvious reasons, is front and center of everyone's attentions at the moment, none of the considerations and judgments that informed in the United Kingdom the integrated review that was published last year have changed when it comes to the benefits and desirability of greater British involvement in the Indo-Pacific as a result of what's happening in Ukraine.
Mm. So I want to shift our conversation a little bit now. So, you know, you currently occupy one of the most senior and important diplomatic posts that an Australian can hold. And I suppose it's one, as your remarks have demonstrated, it's one that gives you a vantage to kind of observe world affairs, not just the Australia-UK relationship, but world affairs more generally. I was wondering if you can give our listeners a sense of how you became entangled and interested in international affairs over the course of your career. You know, was it something that started for you during your legal career, or was it something that you were more drawn to in the course of your parliamentary experience?
Well, it's a lifelong interest, and like you, Will, I am someone who has always read deeply in history. And other than Australian history, my great interests have been European and British history. As a senator And as a minister, I never held a foreign policy portfolio, although I did represent the foreign minister in the Senate when Julie Bishop was the foreign minister during the Abbott and Turnbull governments. So in that sense, I've always had from a ministerial point of view, an engagement, albeit an institutionally somewhat peripheral engagement, in the foreign affairs portfolio. As a diplomat, having been appointed to this job, I've drawn upon a lifelong of reading and study of European history and politics and British history and politics, which has been very serviceable to performing this role.
Mm. So, kind of on that line, I mean, the occupant of Stoke Lodge, I suppose, has always, you know, been something of the dress circle of historical events. But it strikes me that your tenure thus far has really been characterized by kind of a dizzying amount of change. You know, Britain's first years out of the EU, the creation of AUKUS, the free trade agreement, and I suppose now the outbreak of war in Europe. I mean, is it exhausting or is it exhilarating?
Well, it's exhilarating. And I mean, you're right. The I've been lucky enough during my tenure to be the High Commissioner at what is a real inflection point in British history, and that inflection point, of course, was Brexit. And particularly with a government in the United Kingdom of the centre-right, a Conservative government, this is the issue that has basically torn British politics, but most particularly Conservative politics, apart. In one form or another since the 1950s. This is, to the late 20th and early 21st century, to the Conservative Party, what Ireland was in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, but even more important, frankly. So the decision in 2016 to leave the European Union and the implementation of that decision by Boris Johnson's government, culminating in Brexit in January 2021, is a real, real inflection point in British history, which will be a marker for as long as the history of these islands is written. And it has also coincided with the rise of an increasingly assertive Russian leadership, as we've seen played out right now in Ukraine, but which has been foreseeable for some time, and also in other parts of the world, the rise of China. As well, it has coincided with a period of a lot of change in American domestic politics and America's engagement with the world, most notably under the rather unpredictable presidency of President Trump. So we have this conjunction of world events that the non-liberal democratic states are becoming more voluble and assertive. The liberal democratic states, traditionally led by the United States, have, I think, suffered from, in recent years, particularly during the Trump presidency, confused and mixed signals in American foreign policy. And here in the United Kingdom, you have seen one of the world's most important nations, a permanent member of the Security Council, the fifth biggest economy in the world, the most powerful military power other than Russia in Europe, decide to take an independent position and to reimagine itself as a global, not merely an Atlantic or European power. So the conjunction of those events was all, you know, in the last 4 years has been, as I say, a real inflection point in the history of the world, but particularly in the history of Britain.
We'll be right back.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story.
In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Around the world, democracies are in crisis. Leaders have become followers. Populists offer glib solutions to complex problems, and people search for answers. Block out the noise. Each week on Democracy Sausage, we go deeper to bring you insights from leading scholars, journalists, and commentators to help you make sense of the world. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian National University. Join me at the Democracy Sausage Hot Plate every Monday and Thursday.
I want to talk about in a moment the pertinence of the AUKUS Pact to that that changing role for Britain, but I wondered if you might also speak a little bit about the importance of the Australia Free Trade Agreement as well.
Well, this has been a time of ever closer engagement, as a direct result of Brexit, I might say, ever closer engagement between Australia and the United Kingdom. Because when the United Kingdom left the European Union, one of the things it needed to establish was a trade policy. I mean, Britain had not had an independent trade policy for more than 40 years because it didn't even have a Department of International Trade because trade policy had been a matter for the EU. So trade was both a consequence of Brexit and a very high priority. And when Prime Minister Johnson, on the Monday after Brexit occurred, gave a famous speech at Greenwich, at the old Greenwich Naval buildings, he talked primarily about trade and global Britain. So global Britain was the slogan that captured Johnson's vision of a post-Brexit Britain. And what his government and his ministers have sought to do is to show that it was more than a slogan, that it was a reality, that it was a strategic reality, that it was a diplomatic reality, that in terms of development goals, it was a reality. But also, importantly, in international trade, it was a reality. Now, the first order of business was, of course, to settle the terms on which Britain would trade with the EU, because the EU overwhelmingly continues to be Britain's largest trading partner. And that was largely settled, although there still is the untidiness over the Northern Ireland Protocol. But after, second only to that, what was important to Britain was to establish new trading relationships that hadn't existed before, or new trading agreements that hadn't existed before. And Australia was the first on the list. And it was very satisfying because my principal job here has been to get the free trade agreement done. In terms of the devotion of my time and effort over the last several years, that has been far and away number one. And that required not just the negotiation of terms of an agreement, most of which was done by trade negotiators, not by me, but also politically within the United Kingdom to work to change an inward culture that was unaccustomed to the idea of Britain as a global trading nation, and to remind both leaders and the public that Britain traditionally has been a great global trading nation and can be again. And the Australia deal was the emblematic, it was the very emblem of that. And when I've been selling the free trade agreement and persuading people that it's a good thing, not just for Australia, but for the United Kingdom, the line I always used with hundreds of interlocutors, I didn't find a single person who was able to disagree. I would say to them, if you can't do a free trade agreement with Australia, who can you do a free trade agreement with? And whether they were enthusiastic Brexiteers who enthusiastically agreed, or whether they were Remainers who were reluctant about it, whether they were enthusiasts or unenthusiastic, everyone accepted that the Australian Free Trade Agreement was emblematic of Britain's capacity to be a global trading nation. And therefore, it took on a political significance here way beyond what I think it had in Australia. It was a good deal for Australia, but we're accustomed to free trade agreements. In Britain, it was emblematic, A, because it was the first non-European deal, but secondly, because it was the deal that really they had to be able to do because if they couldn't do a deal with us, they weren't going to have a successful trade policy. And that then raised the next question: if you can't do a deal with Australia on free trade, what was the point of Brexit? What was the agony all for? So it's been a very important in British domestic politics. The Australian Free Trade Agreement had a significance and weight and symbolic importance way beyond its substantive terms.
And I suppose the other big agreement that's been occupying your time and will likely occupy the time of many of your successors is the AUKUS Pact,
which is in geopolitical terms is a game changer.
Yeah.
So I mean, the free trade agreement with the UK had been an objective of Australian policy for some years in one form or another since Brexit, but it came to fulfilment in the last year and a half. AUKUS was more recent in its conception and in its accomplishment, and the thing to emphasise about AUKUS is that it is a real partnership between three like-minded nations, each the leading power in its region of the world, in Australia, in the Southern Hemisphere between the Indian Ocean and the Pacific, the fulcrum nation of the fulcrum liberal democracy of the Indo-Pacific. The United States, obviously, as both an Atlantic and a Pacific power, and the United Kingdom as one of the leading European liberal democracies. So the fact that we decided to merge our interests in this comprehensive capability development pact, which with global reach, but with an emphasis on the Indo-Pacific, I think is an inflection point in the history of our region, at least.
So is that why you think it was important that the exchange of this technology have this AUKUS construct focused on the Indo-Pacific around it? Because it strikes me that there was an option to just exchange the technology under, you know, an updated ANZUS treaty or even just under the Five Eyes partnership. Was it critical that the exchange of nuclear propulsion technology also be accompanied by this kind of new diplomatic construct?
I think it needed a structure. It needed a structure around it which was more than just a bespoke agreement. And the thing to bear in mind, at the AUKMIN meeting in Sydney in January, the ministers were very conscious to emphasise this. AUKUS is not just about nuclear-powered submarines. The nuclear-powered submarine project is the first big item in AUKUS, and people understand it. It's very tangible. But AUKUS is much broader than that. People speak about Pillar 1 of AUKUS, which is the submarines, and Pillar 2, which is the other capabilities on which we are going to develop in partnership, whether it be artificial intelligence, whether it be quantum computing, whether it be cyber technology, both defensive and aggressive, whether it be joint projects in space in years to come. These are projects which are less advanced and more amorphous, but they're just as much a part of the AUKUS vision as the submarines. In other words, this is a broadly based, long-term, joint mutual capability development endeavour.
So I'm mindful that I'm taking up a decent period of your time, but before we finish, I'd be interested to kind of get your insights briefly about the kind of nature of your role day to day? You know, how have you handled being head of mission for a post where the relationship is so expansive as you've kind of outlined? I mean, it must feel like a challenge to be across every single aspect of what's going on in so many parts of the relationship, given how close the agencies work together.
Well, the agencies do work very close together, that both at a defence level, the intelligence agencies, the policing agencies do work very close together. But of course, the relationship between countries is ultimately a relationship at the political level. Now, at the moment in Australia, you have, and in the United Kingdom, you have two like-minded governments. You have two prime ministers, Scott Morrison and Boris Johnson, who are friends, who get on very well. The degree of like-mindedness between us is very high, and that is, and the degree of familiarity and ease of dealing between like-minded and mutually trusting partners is unusually high. There was an opinion poll conducted in the United Kingdom in the last week of February, which showed that among the British public, the country of which they had the most favourable impression of all the countries in the world was Australia. The Lowy Institute, in its public attitude survey last year, when it posed the question, which country do you most trust to act responsibly in the world? The Australian public put Britain at the top. So this is a time in which these two countries have a higher level of confidence in one another than either of them have in any other country. So it's a really purple patch in the relationship. The common values, the shared interests will always underlie that, but on top of, and they will always be the most important thing, I think, but on top of shared values and common interests, there is this efflorescence of goodwill and trust and like-mindedness and kinship between the two countries, which I think is greater today than it's ever been in peacetime. Mm.
So, you know, you mentioned there that you didn't come to the role of High Commissioner from a kind of traditional diplomatic career. Do you think there's room in the modern diplomatic service to see more people from wider backgrounds to take up appointments like high commissionships or others, you know, potentially including even people from business or think tanks?
Definitely. Definitely. I mean, without any disrespect to people who pursue careers within the Department of Foreign Affairs as professional diplomats, who will always be the overwhelming majority of Australia's heads of mission, there are some places where there is a distinct advantage in being having a broader life experience than being a public servant enables you to have. Whether it be in places like London and Washington, where a senior member of the cabinet is almost by convention regarded as the having a skill set that brings additional weight and gravitas to the role, whether it be in places like, for example, Barry O'Farrell in India, who draws upon not only his experience as a state premier, but as a person who for many years has been integral to building at a commercial level the Australia-India commercial relationship. It's a horses for courses thing. And there are certain posts in which having, as I say, both the weight of seniority and the breadth of experience that is not available within the narrow channels of a public service department adds immense value. Mm.
So, High Commissioner, I want to thank you for being so generous with your time and to speak to our audience. I know these are obviously very busy times for you and the teams here at Australia House. So, you know, thank you very much for your time and thank you for your hard work.
Thank you very much, Will.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.